Good morning and welcome to Thursday Morning Roundtable. My name is Sandra Barrett, and on behalf of University College of Syracuse University, it's my pleasure to welcome you here this morning as we round out the March programs with a recreation of sorts of the March 1965 Thursday Morning Roundtable, the first four programs of TMR 50 years ago. So we've been talking about some serious economic, social, political issues, as we often do, and as they did in the early days of the roundtable. But just a heads up, next week we're going to be taking a slight diversion, and we're going to be talking baseball. Jason Smorrell, the general manager of the Syracuse Chiefs, is going to be here. It will be just a week before the season opener of the Chiefs, and 2 weeks before the first home game, which I believe is on April 16th. So things are going to change a lot between now and then. So next week we're going to be talking baseball. As you know, we have been recreating the March 1965 programs, as I mentioned. I think it was March 25th of 1965, John Lascaris, who was the Commissioner of Public Welfare for the county, was the speaker, and the topic was the dilemma of public welfare as it is today. Remember last week we were talking about social action in Syracuse, and I mentioned that in 1965 the city had been one of the grantees of one of the first War on Poverty programs, and we had the Community Action Training Program, and that was the TMR speaker of the day, Professor Hagstrom, and Saul Alinsky was one of the members of that group, and they were kind of seen as rabble-rousers. The mayor and some of the other, you know, kind of powers that be weren't really happy about it. Well, when I was looking online to try to find some information about what John Lascaris was talking about in March 1965, what I came up with was a newspaper article from, it was actually September of 1965. And if you see the headline, it was Demand Clothing. And it was a demonstration, apparently the first day of school in September, a lot of people kept their children home from school. These were recipients of public assistance because they were claiming that they didn't have enough money for raincoats and outerwear for their children. And reading kind of between the lines, I'm thinking that Professor Hagstrom was behind it with those several dozen demonstrators in Mr. Lascaris's office. So it's all tied together, and it was very interesting days. So today, to talk about the dilemma of public welfare, I'm very happy to introduce Ann Rooney, who's a deputy county executive for human services in Onondaga County. She's responsible for several areas of human services, including corrections, health, probation, social services, 911, emergency management, and adult and long-term care, and children and family. So thank you, Anne, for joining us today, and I'm sure it's going to be a really interesting conversation.
Thank you, Sandra. And when I heard about next week's topic, I'd really prefer to talk about that. It seems like a lot of fun. Baseball's right up my alley. When Sandra asked me to do this probably 6 weeks ago, and if you've ever received that phone call from Sandra in her calm and assuring way, you're like, sure, I can do this. And she sent me the subsequent email, what she just described, and I immediately called my two partners in crime, Sarah Merrick, our Commissioner of Social Services, and David Sukwi, our previous commissioner, who's now our Commissioner of Children and Family Services. And I said with big four letters, help! And so... But this has really turned out to be just a fascinating topic for me personally because of the work that we do every day, but then looking backwards about where we've come from and where we're headed. And so much of this is just centered around persons and helping persons, but looking back, and I think you're going to find it fascinating, some of the differences that happened in a very short time between 1961 here in this community and 1965. So please, whoops, is that okay? Please, I'm going to go through the PowerPoint because there is a lot of information, particularly with the numbers, and I am going to piggyback a little off of what Sandra said because she gave me a little hint about the climate. And just so you know, Professor, is it Hagstrom? Did I pronounce it correctly? I did find out he was subsequently released by Syracuse University. So just as a little public welfare historical perspective, kind of to set the tone, and I got a lot of assistance. We have the New York State Public Welfare Association. They have yet to change their name, and Sheila Hannigan is their executive director, and part of my help cry, David Sutkwe, reached out to them, and they just provided, they have a lot of the numbers that I'm just fascinated that they have about, we don't have it in Onondaga County, number of clients, who received what, and dollars spent. So just as a quick, very quick historical perspective, Sheila let us know right out of the gate that public welfare, public assistance goes back at least, you know, 1,000 years to the Roman Empire when they were giving out grain. But then China was quite progressive in those days by having retirement homes, public clinics, and public graveyards. Fast forward to 1601 in Great Britain and the formal establishment of the poor laws. And this is where our model in the United States subsequently came from. They had two types of relief at that time, workhouses, which was indoor relief, and what they were really trying to do is to keep the able-bodied off of public assistance. And when they say workhouses, they really meant institutionalization. They then moved to the idea of outdoor relief, and that is, you know, started to move to that idea of public assistance, providing money, clothing, and without that idea of institutionalization. That's a tough word, over and over, institutionalization. By the early 20th century, Great Britain had moved more to a model that we now have today. So let's move to the United States and what happened. Prior to the Great Depression, there were local governments, charitable organizations, religious organizations were largely responsible for implementing what were the poor laws in the United States. We had the county home that everyone probably has driven by many, many times up on Route 173 on Onondaga Hill, and that was the poorhouse in what was then Onondaga County. It really tried to discourage dependency at that point. If you drive by now, particularly at night, and you see the beautifully lit up H1 building on the OCC campus, that was our poorhouse. So then we move into the Great Depression, FDR's New Deal, and the poorhouses really began to disappear starting in 1935 with the passage of the Social Security Act. I'm going to slow down because I'm just giving you this quick historical part of it. There are so many components of FDR's New Deal, but one that really launched us into that idea of government-sponsored public welfare was the aid to dependent children. That lasted, that whole concept lasted from 1935 to 1996. So when we had LBJ's War on Poverty, aid to dependent children lasted through that time into welfare reform, sponsored by President Clinton. Sandra pointed out about the War on Poverty, and don't miss the fact that in 1938, Onondaga County established its own welfare department. But in the War on Poverty, many, many of the programs that are still in existence today were created. So you now had food stamps, Medicare, Medicaid, some others, but I highlight on this the Community Action Program that Sandra highlighted because there was the Economic Opportunity Act. And in this piece was this idea that people should have the ability to direct their own lives. And this really started that idea of community action, community training in that sense. So now I'm going to take you a little bit back. As part of what we did, and again, I want to thank Sarah Merrick. She somehow, when I told her about this, she dug out, and I hope she can dig out a lot more, the 1961 and 1965 annual reports from our then departments of social welfare. And I just want you to see the theme in 1961, which very much mirrors our mission today. And so I'm just going to read it because there's another part I want to read as we transition into 1965. and because we're on the radio and they can't see the PowerPoint. The objectives of public assistance cannot be limited to establishing eligibility and giving assistance as needed. The ultimate objective must be a restoration of the individual and family to a level of self-sufficiency. It involves an additional function of careful and objective examination of the cause of dependency and casework treatment focused on SAME. And that was Commissioner Lewis Harreld. In his memo to John Mulroy, then county executive, I just want to read part of the conclusion because it really is fascinating to see what changed in 4 years. He says, there are no simple solutions to the complex problems of welfare. We see our task is more than a routine job of providing material needs. We see it as an opportunity for advancement of health, and welfare of children, conservation of family and individual morale, stimulation of self-sufficiency, and the release of constructive forces in the lives of people through granting them some measure of personal as well as material security. When I read that, and I'm done with 1961 for now, when I read that, it so mirrors our mission today and what we hold is truly being public servants, serving the people, trying to help people in so many facets of their lives to get out of poverty. So then, the topic today was 1965, but having that 1961 perspective and what Sandra already talked about a little bit, we then had John Lascaris's annual report, and I was startled. It was a very short memo to the still County Executive Mulroy, and the tone has changed. And he says, events of the past year included dramatic confrontations with the aggressive organizers of organizations of the poor, who exhibited more intensive anger about alleged injustices. These actions involved the harassment, derision, and ridicule of staff on various levels that makes the traditionally comfortable agency as uncomfortable as possible. And he goes on to say, all these events caused a staff turnover of 30% of caseworkers. I can't imagine if Sarah Merrick had to come in my office and tell me that 30% of the staff quit, because we would have basically turned off the lights at that point. It would be very, very difficult. So when Sandra talked about this and sent me the email about all this, I had to go back and really look at the climate. And Sandra went over a lot of this, but part of that 1964 legislation was the establishment of the Community Action Program, enabling men and women throughout the country to prepare long-range plans for the attack on poverty in their own communities. Interestingly, Syracuse University received the first federal grant to do this. And I can imagine there was a lot of excitement to help organize the poor, to help themselves. And again, as Sandra pointed out, the pioneering community organizer, still legendary community organizer, Saul Alinsky of Chicago, was hired as a consultant. His most famous work is Rules for Radicals. So you can imagine how Commissioner Lascaris, you know, was a little bit inundated with everything that was happening at that time. Going forward, and I also have the demand for clothing and on the next slide, but I want to also point out that political realities are real. So within 1 year's time, there was a whole huge study done on this, but during 65, several autonomous community organizations were formed and functioning in Syracuse, much to the dismay of City Hall. But by the end of 1965, the Community Action Training Center was defunded and being dismantled by the university. So the reality at the time was, I'm sure, if we all put ourselves back there, this is a great idea, but Syracuse University was no longer willing to be the sponsor of this. But out of this came, who are still existing today, are many community organizations and community action groups that still exist. I'm sure you've all heard of Syracuse United Neighbors came out of this. We still have all of the neighborhood groups around Citizens of Pioneer Homes, James Geddes, Central Village, and the Northeast organization. So the Colonel was started here in Syracuse, and I find that fascinating for all of us. For those of you who are here, I hope during the question period that you actually educate me more on it, because it's truly fascinating. So let's talk about now going from 1965, Bill Clinton in 1996 had historical legislation. So what we saw from 1965 was a steady increase in those on public assistance, all of the programs that I've already spoken of, Medicaid, cash assistance, food stamps, child support for children in daycare. And there really was a tone in the country that those on welfare were really just living off the public dole, that there ought to be a requirement for work, that we can't just let people be on welfare for their whole lives. So it was historical in nature in 1996 with what was passed called the Personal Responsibility and Work Opportunity Act. And I think Bill Clinton has, as a Democrat, is particularly well known for having passage of this bill. He called it the end of welfare as we know it, and that welfare is a second chance, not a way of life. New York State, just so everyone here knows, New York State passed its own welfare reform in 1997. And New York is different than almost every other state in the union, because in our Constitution, we have a responsibility to provide for the aid, care, and support of the needy. And what this meant for New York, in the federal legislation, there's a 5-year time limit on how long someone can receive temporary assistance, cash assistance. New York State does not have that because of this constitutional requirement. And some say that New York has become a haven for welfare recipients. I'm not sure the numbers show that out, but more just the economy has shifted. So then the question, has welfare reform worked in New York? And again, as I go through this, there are clear differences, and Sarah works with this every day. Those who are on cash assistance are very different in makeup and demographic than the rest of the population who are really considered the working poor. So you may have, you know, we have thousands and thousands of people here in this community who are considered the working poor. They go to work every single day, but there are government programs that they avail themselves of that allow them to be just above the poverty level. I'm not saying they're, you know, living the American dream, but it allows them to be just above that poverty level that perhaps in some ways makes us feel better about ourselves, but it allows them to live lives of dignity, we hope. So, what happened? Cash assistance. That's what everybody thinks of when they think of welfare. They think the person coming in, getting their monthly check, and what do they do with that? So in Onondaga County in May of 1994 was our high water for the number of cases we had of temporary assistance at 13,800. Today we are down to 6,500 cases, and again, that's cash assistance. So what we have done essentially, and all of our systems work in tandem for this, is to move from this cash assistance to a work support system, recognizing that people still need help to achieve greater independence. I would be remiss if I didn't mention Jobs Plus and the work that they do. They are situated at 677 South Salina Street, and I know that because I used to be on the floor below working for the Salvation Army. And they are our work employment arm. And they just last week, 2 weeks ago, Sarah, celebrated their 20th anniversary of providing work-like settings, work for people in this community. And over the last 20 years, they have placed over 50,000 people in permanent jobs. So they do a great job, and they really are our partner. We do have plans to, in the next couple of years, move them into the Civic Center and have them be more integrated with our Department of Social Services staff, because everything they do is working together with us. And at some point, the idea of having them have to go 6 blocks down the street and then come back, there's a lot of inefficiencies in that. So the numbers. Everybody likes the numbers. I was a little startled by the numbers. In 1965, and again, our population in Onondaga County frankly, hasn't changed much between 1965 and today. Somewhere always between that 450,000 to 480,000 mark. So in 1965, we had 21,615 discrete individuals. We always use that word, two words, discrete individuals, representing 4.8% of the county population. The total cost in 1965, and this is the information we got from New York State, the Public Welfare Association, because we do not have all this. The total cost was $17.3 million, and inflation adjusted, today that would be $128 million. Let's, going forward, in this case, 49 years, but 50 years for all intents and purposes, in 2014, we had 114,000 discrete individuals representing 24% of our county population receiving some type of public assistance. These are discrete individuals, so that is very important. And our total cost was a staggering almost $1.2 billion. And that number represents more than anything the expansion of public assistance. So why the increases? In 1965, Medicaid didn't exist. And recipients of Medicaid in Onondaga County, we are responsible for eligibility determinations. The money that comes into this community to fund Medicaid from the federal government with the New York State match and our capped part of it was $813 million of that $1.2 billion total. So the fact that it didn't exist was largely the reason. Medicaid, food stamps, HEAP, child care subsidies largely support the working poor in this community, all of these. So you'd put cash assistance over here, 6,500 cases representing about 13,000 people. If I have that right, Sarah, I keep looking at her. She keeps nodding, and so I'm good to go. But all of those programs support the rest of this community, and to think that nearly 25% of our population is receiving some type of public assistance while they go to work every day is really, it's almost mind-blowing to me. So the other part of this is in 1965, you see that almost 6,600 people received cash assistance. So it was only a little over 4% of the population. Today on cash assistance, even though the numbers have blown up so exponentially, only 8,800 people get cash assistance. So those numbers aren't that divergent. It is the rest of the public assistance numbers that support the working poor. The other reason, which we've all heard about over and over, is the end of the manufacturing economy. Especially here in Syracuse and Onondaga County, we lost almost every one of our huge manufacturers, and with that went jobs that supported families and could support families well above the poverty line. For us in Onondaga County, the 2008 crash just ballooned our caseloads, which I will show you. It was remarkable. This is just a slide that shows in the United States what happened to the manufacturing economy. In 1970, from nearly, about 27% of our jobs, it's a couple of years missing at the end, but down to only 10%, and not a lot of it is here in Onondaga County. So now, before we move into more numbers for today, we have to think about the philosophy and practicality of welfare today. It is wholly different than it used to be. I don't know that people's mindsets are completely different, but in practicality and administration, it is very, very different from what it was 50 years ago. It really used to be equated with the unemployed and unemployable. Now, as the numbers have shown, it is far more likely that a person receiving assistance is working. And who the typical, and that's what you would always hear over the years. You would always say, is it the welfare queen? Who's the typical cash assistance welfare recipient? And I asked Sarah, and she is fantastic. And just as a side note, we are thrilled to have her as our social services commissioner. But when I ask her a question, by the end of the day, she has the answer laid out in perfect form, and I'm always good to go. But who of these 6,300 cases, what's the demographic? So if I had, before I put this up, if I had asked you, would it have been a surprise that the average person receiving cash assistance, the age is 39? It's not your single mom who's 24 years old with three kids. She probably is being asked to join the workforce and is making all attempts to do that. Of those cases, 51% of them have a physical or mental health disability that makes it impossible for them to work. Just in, as part of our system, when someone comes in to Onondaga County and applies for temporary assistance in that condition, we, as quickly as possible, tried to move them over to SSI on the federal side because it alleviates a lot of the burden financially for us. They still work with us, but they're more appropriately placed with the federal government. Of these cases, 69% of them have households with dependent children. And when Sarah told me this number, I was just a little bit staggered that 95% of the stipends that people receive for cash assistance go towards their housing costs. We leave about 5% so for incidentals that they could purchase that they can't purchase with food stamps. So that's where we are today. So the question, are we better off today than we were in 1965? And again, this was really, for me personally, this was a lot of fun to put this together. I felt like I was back in college turning in that great paper. So thanks, Sandra. I hope it's great. But when you look back in the, she showed me how to use a pointer. When you look back at where we are, this blue line is the official poverty rate. And if you look back in the first year on the chart is 1967. The official poverty rate, and then what we call the green line, is the supplemental poverty measure. So those are the government transfers that allow a person or family to live above the poverty line. So you can see in 1967, they were almost identical. As you go across the years, you can see that widening, that the supplemental poverty measure is all those government assistance programs pushed in that keep people above the poverty line, being that official rate right there. So essentially, and the biggest factor in all this was Social Security and continues to be. So Social Security alone reduces the elderly poverty rate from 44% without counting Social Security benefits to 9% with them. So when we talk about Social Security and its benefits since 1935, clearly it has had a very positive impact for a lot of people. Then the rest of the anti-poverty programs, if we took them out right now, so the figures tell us over and over, absent the anti-poverty policies, the 2012 rate would be a poverty rate of 29%, meaning that the value of food stamps, unemployment benefits, earned income tax credits, housing subsidies, etc., lifted 13% or 40 million people out of poverty. So when we talk about that and we talk about dismantling a lot of these systems, the impact on our nation would just be catastrophic. I really like this slide. And I've got to do that one. Okay. So when we talk about this, and I think we've seen over the last couple of years, there's a real groundswell from those who have recovered after the 2008 crash, and those who are still suffering exponentially from this. And when I look at this and I think about it, and I really went back to school with this one, but the theories of Locke, Hobbes, Rousseau, that whole idea of the social contract, and you know, it's an agreement for mutual benefit between an individual or group and the government or and community as a whole. So we are seeing a real change in our nation. And, you know, we hear it all the time, the shrinking of the middle class, all of those things. But I thought a very interesting statistic was this second one. In 1947, labor received 67% of non-farm business output. At the end of 1973, that figure still stood at 66%. In 2012, labor received only 58% of total output, the lowest by far in the entire post-war period. When compensation fails to keep pace with productivity, workers' purchasing power becomes less able to sustain economic growth. So this transformation of the U.S. economy to a real service orientation away from manufacturing is really starting to have people think about what is this social contract that government has with its citizenry, or we as a community have with our fellow community stakeholders. And when I see, you know, McDonald's really going through this with all of its employees, that on the national level there really is starting to be this ups, you know, people thinking the inequality of pay is really, really unfair in a lot of ways. And Sarah hasn't had anyone in her office screaming and yelling at her as Commissioner Lascaris did. But I also think this is much more on a national level that we are going to have to continue to keep thinking about the decisions we make. When we talk about dismantling or reducing some of these programs, we have to think of the consequences. A couple of years ago, I stood here before you and talked about our human services reorganization. And that took a lot of planning from a lot of people in county government. And when you undertake something like that, you have to ask a lot of questions, the hard questions, that if we hadn't asked them of ourselves, we would have been remiss in what we were asking the public to accept from us. So one of the questions that we asked, a couple of this I think was 2011 into 2012, was this idea of what's the effect of education? Because with our reorganization, we, for the first time in New York State, have in our Department of Children and Family Services a division called Division of School-Based Initiatives. We are working very much in alignment with the Syracuse City School District. We're starting discussions now with Solve and some other districts about how we as a county and the mandates and responsibilities we have can better work in concert with the school districts, not on the academic side in any way, shape, or form, but on those social, emotional supports that allow children to succeed in the classroom, that allow them to have the attention they need because their family has been able to access Medicaid, food stamps, a psychological counselor if needed. So when you embark on something like this, we had to ask the question, what is the effect of education? And with our giant welfare databases that we have, we were able to discern that on the local level, 75% of persons receiving public benefits do not have a high school degree. So when we talk about what matters, education matters. I said, let's take it one step further. How about a college degree? So we really looked then just at the cash assistance, because that on the for all of them, it's a little higher, but those that everybody really has this objection to, not everybody, but a number of people have this objection to cash assistance. So in Onondaga County, there are 8,759 adults receiving cash assistance. 63 of them have a college degree. So when we talk about why we make the decisions we do in this alignment with education, this, more than anything, is why. New York State is undergoing, and I switched a little, Sandra, because it's so near and dear to my heart about child well-being, but the impact of poverty. And New York State is taking on this whole idea of it's not enough to just get a family and children, you know, this far above the poverty line in order to succeed. It still doesn't create a lot of opportunity. So statewide, they're embarking on this idea of child well-being. They're looking a lot at what Onondaga County is doing. And I would, again, be remiss if I didn't thank our county executive, Joni Mahoney, who kind of just says to me, go ahead, try it. Let's see what works. And having that latitude to think like that from a governmental organization aspect is just, it allows, we love coming to work every day, I can attest to. But it's because of this. Child well-being is so linked to poverty. And this chart shows you, here were our caseloads in 08-09, the first year of the crash. So temporary assistance went up 12%. By the end of 2013, our caseloads had increased 61% over that five-year period. Food stamps, now called SNAP, in that first year, 14%. Now it's up 87% in 5 years. Medicaid, 4%, likewise went up 41%. So this is a challenge for all of us. It's a challenge for us internally in the county to address these issues without adding any staff, I might add, actually reducing it. But this really points to that fundamental shift in the American economy. So much psychological research has demonstrated that living in poverty has a wide range of negative effects on the physical and mental health and well-being of our children. And this is something, when we talk about the linkages that we try to implement, is in front and center for us every day. I just had to, I'm going to transition now to innovation and efficiency. So in the 1961 report, Commissioner Harold was very excited about the fact that they were leasing data processing machines from IBM. So I had to go find a picture of what a data processing machine looks like. And I could imagine if we handed those to one of our workers, or we couldn't hand it. We'd have to have it carried in. But they were very excited about this. I work with Bill Fisher every day. And he passes me, and he's carrying something in his hands the other day. I go, what is that? He goes, we're getting workbooks, you know, the little, we're going to try them out. And Bill, if you know Bill, is so technologically proficient. But the idea that our caseworkers, our food inspectors, that everybody will be armed with equipment that allows them to be more efficient in the field is something that we're looking forward to. I would also like to point out something the county executive highlighted in her State of the County speech. We just this week, aren't they beautiful? we installed 8, what we're just calling kiosks, because maybe we could come up with something a little more creative, self-serve kiosks. They look a lot like ATM machines. And again, this is a credit to our staff and their ingenuity. A couple of them went to a conference, and one county was saying that they let, you know, the people who are turning in information use a scanner, and then they scan it, and then they could hand it in. And our folks came back and said, you know, that sounds okay, but I think we can do a little better. So they really did some investigation and found these machines out in California, and they really are like an ATM machine. But now what it allows our recipients, our applicants, to do, if you ever come into the Civic Center and go up the escalator to the second floor, which is our intake unit, you will oftentimes see lines out the door, every seat occupied. We are right now designing a new whole floor to make this more accommodating for the public and our workforce as well. But so many people are, as I've described, these are the working poor. So they're leaving their jobs to come in and sometimes turn in a birth certificate, a Social Security card, a budget that they had to work on. And it's lost work time. There's no doubt about it. And so they're jeopardizing their employment to receive their public benefits. So to Sarah Merrick's credit and to her whole team, they came to us with this idea, I want to say maybe October. And, you know, being in the political reality that we live in, I said, can they be installed by the State of the County? And they were installed. They just weren't. We had to finish the programming. But so an individual can come in now, and we have somebody going through the line, kind of like when you're in the security checkpoint at the airport, and they say, who has TA pre-check? And they say, come on over here. This is kind of the same idea, that if all you're doing is turning in a document, you can go over to this machine, put it in, it scans it, it sends it directly to your case, and you get a receipt back saying that you've submitted it. Because so often, that's the barrier with our caseworkers and the public, that, oh, no, we don't have that. Well, they have the receipt. So we installed these on Monday. And again, this we originally estimated we were going to divert 500 people out of the line in a month. Well, in 3 days, we've diverted over 500 people. And so this, what we're planning to do with this, oh, clap for her. But what we're planning to do with this is, once we know they're up operational, is to install them at places like the Salvation Army, Catholic Charities, Rescue Mission, different places where the public comes for other types of services, but they could do it there. They don't have to come to the Civic Center. So those are some of the things we're doing. I can't thank Sandra enough for really letting me be educated on what happened since 1965. And again, I just want to say thank you. Thank you to Sarah, and I'm happy to take any questions. I think that was it. So.
Thank you, Anne. That was beyond all my expectations. And I want you to know that I really appreciate it. I'm sure we all really appreciate it. That was a fascinating look back and forward as well. I want to say on behalf of the Citizens League, which over the past year has been studying the skills gap, that you mentioned the issue of wage rates and, you know, the inequities, because that's certainly one of the issues that we've talked about that's a local issue, but it's a national issue, and we're not going to get past that by ourselves. Sarah.
Good morning. Good morning. One of the things that you didn't mention, which always has me curious about this type of discussion, is deinstitutionalization occurred at the same time. And how does that affect those numbers?
You mean the deinstitutionalization?
Yes.
Yes, it did. And many, many of those people they're the 52% on temporary assistance who are disabled. And it is a continuing challenge because no one wanted to keep anyone in an institution. But at the same time, we have to have the services in the community available to them to allow them to live independently. So that's something that is especially on the mental health side, is a challenge for us every day. Bob Long, who is our Commissioner of Adult and Long-Term Care Services, is continually working on community placement and the supports around that. So, yes, we don't want people in institutions, but we have to do a better job of supporting them in the community.
The $813 million in Medicaid, I'm wondering if you could tell us what percentage of that is dedicated to long-term care, particularly nursing home care, because it would seem to be a subsidy for people who had been working middle-class folks. And another question about Medicaid would be with the advent of Obamacare, what kind of impact has that had in terms of the increase in income eligibility on your responsibilities?
Okay. The first part of the question, over roughly 52% of the Medicaid costs are for people in long-term care facilities. And one of the interesting things, and that so often is a question that we receive, is of the caseload of Medicaid, Sarah, 70,000 people in Onondaga County, roughly? Of those 70,000, if 50% of the money is being spent on nursing home care and that type of care, we also asked, are people availing themselves of Medicaid? So we're hearing all this money about, or all this talk about hospitals having to avoid people going to emergency rooms. But for so many people, the emergency room is their primary care physician. And so when we look at that, and especially linking it to that child well-being part of it, the numbers of people who they have Medicaid, but do, you know, are they going for their well checkups and all that? Only 22% of people on Medicaid are actually using the benefit. And so that's something that we want to increase as well. On the effect of Obamacare, and for us, it hasn't been that different because Medicaid in New York State is, compared to other states, so expansive. So has it allowed those people in between to access medical care? Yes. I think the answer would be different if you were to ask one of the hospitals the effect it's had on them. But from the county perspective, not that much different because we're in New York State.
Just a comment. In the Economic Opportunity Act, every county was designated a community action agency. And the community action agency in Onondaga County is PEACE Incorporated, which is an acronym for People's Equal Action Community Effort.
Yes, and in fact, I think if I had that in there, that it was part of city-county government. Really, I think the first origination of the Youth Bureau was the community action component. And because of all of was going on, they formed PEACE Incorporated, which continues today and is just doing great work.
Right, right. The predecessor of PEACE was kind of going on at the same time as the Community Action Training Program, and it survived where the other program was very short-lived.
Okay. Great presentation. Last night, the city had their community development block grant public hearing, and they discussed, you know, the affordable housing situation. And you didn't touch on the issue of the amount of money that people get, particularly single adults that are on that individual, and that relationship to the fair market rents in the county. So I think love you to talk about, and I know this is out of your control because the amount
like
of
most
money
things.
Comes from the state state legislature.
Thanks. Yes, it does. And you're absolutely right. And we continually strive to find not only affordable but adequate housing for these folks who receive temporary assistance. On a side note, New York State is one of the only states that allows single adults to even receive temporary assistance. And again, I pointed out to the percentage of it that goes to rent, 95%, and it demonstrates exactly what you're saying. It's still not enough to pay for what would be housing that would be appropriate for someone. And yes, I agree with you, and it is out of my control, but the state is the one who sets these rates. And again, we, and I'm not trying to deflect here, but we don't administer, we just determine eligibility. But at the same time, we're working with the housing vulnerable every day because they come to us for emergency stipends, things like that, our shelters, all of those things, as we try to get people into housing that is appropriate and respectful and dignifying.
$385 a month. So as you know, you can't really find an apartment for that kind of money. So that's why we're in this housing bind with people in poverty, particularly singles.
Since we all recognize the word welfare is a pejorative term, and you've talked about the subsidies to the working poor, are they not in fact really subsidies to the corporations who pay them, underpay them, so this is really corporate welfare?
That's what I was touching on the revised social contract. I just didn't take it quite that far. But pejoratively, I agree with you.
Yep, that's absolutely right. Thank you. All right. Fred, that's right. I saw your hand up. Thank you.
I was reading recently about Franklin Roosevelt's second Bill of Rights, I think it was, that he was trying to promote just before he died. And I think one of the tenets of that was that if you work or that you are entitled to a living wage, to support yourself and your family if you are working full time. I think Bill Clinton said something, the same thing. If you work hard and play by the rules, you should be able to get by. But in terms of the social contract, your great presentation really seemed to bring things together and suggest that with the decline of manufacturing jobs, the kind of jobs people are doing just economically cannot produce that kind of income. So the social contract today, and maybe you would comment on that maybe in future, particularly with earned income credit and things like that, social contract is that the government's going to have to make people whole pretty much from now on.
And you're absolutely right, and that was the assertion that I was making. But you do have some states like the state of Washington where the minimum wage, I believe, is up to the $14, $15 amount. And you aren't hearing that Seattle and other places are just falling apart. In fact, places like Seattle are thriving. But that issue of wage equality, I think, and I agree 100%, is going to just keep percolating and percolating because we are now very much a service sector-oriented economy. And as long as this continues, I don't see a change in that. Everybody, the best equation of it is fast food, that we, our faster lives, speedier lives, those who can afford to pay for it are going to supplement those on the lower end. Unless there's a radical change, I don't see it changing.
Radical. There's that word again. Rules for radicals.
We have a dysfunctional Congress, which we all agree on, I'm sure, and we can't predict how things are going to come out with the present budget debate, but it appears as if the Republicans wish to sharply reduce all these supports for the working poor. If that in fact happens, can you sort of visualize what impact that would have on our community?
I think what would, if they remove these supports, more and more people are going to be eligible for cash assistance, you know, if they don't change that part of it. And one of the interesting components, and Peggy Luizzi is here, and former executive director of Child Care Solutions, and she would talk to me about this all the time, that if, in fact, more people are put out of work, the working poor, they are now more eligible for child care subsidies than the working poor. And who falls off the ranks of who would be eligible are the working poor. So I think what you would have if this continues and they reduce these amounts, that you would just have more and more people eligible for cash assistance, which, tying it all together, we know you can't live on. You know, you can't find an affordable place to live. So if there is success in dismantling some of these programs, I think there just really will be, I don't want, chaos is a very strong word, but it would be very, very difficult on the local level, especially in New York State, because we pick up the burden, unlike some other states, of sharing the federal share of some of these programs.
Periodically, an organization or a legislator will put forth the argument all welfare recipients should be drug tested. Could you address that?
I am going to just take a nugget from my boss, Joni Mahoney. When she is on the New York State Association of Counties, and when that was put forward, she said, I will support drug testing when all of us as county executives are subjected to drug testing. That it's not fair to ask the poor and downtrodden to do something that you wouldn't be willing to do yourself. And that is, in a nutshell, that was her answer, and I agree.
As I was reading, again, going back in history and trying to find out when the county welfare department was established, and as you said, it was in the late 30s, it was interesting. There was no county government per se then. There was no county executive. There was no legislature. But as I mentioned, when we had the mayor, at the time, the mayor was a Republican in the 30s, even. The city was Republican. And this very interesting consolidation of the city and town welfare departments, because then there were welfare departments, but there was one in every town, was undertaken by the mayor. And it was done very efficiently. Consensus, take note. But, because, well, he just did it, basically. Because most of the, as you would expect, the urban poor were using most of the benefits. And it was a way to finance it fairly, as we know. But that was a bit of history. Okay, now I'm at our questioner, Bill.
The teacher, the social work educator in me, cannot resist the opportunity to remind us that the discussion we're having now is about 500 years old, going back to the Elizabethan poor laws. The comment by this gentleman back here about corporate welfare is right on point. There is something called a principle of least eligibility that is in our welfare system that is designed to give people, provide people or force people to work. We will never see in the society in which we live people being provided with adequate income off of welfare payments, because we have to ensure that they want to work. And that's what this is all about. And until we figure that out, the mess that we're in now will continue. So I want to thank Sarah. Thank you for what you are trying to do. But we're really butting our heads against the brick wall. And this is not to say we shouldn't do anything, but that's what we're up against.
We've got time for another question.
Good morning. Thank you for your informative presentation. And it's amazing to be in a room of so many knowledgeable people with all of these excellent questions. I was just curious, you talked about the impact of the economy, and certainly we've had an influx of non-native born Americans during that time period. Could you perhaps, number one, speak to that issue and how that's impacted those statistics? And then secondly, could you talk a bit about some interventions that the county is planning for the future to address those findings that you were able to find by putting together this talk, and some preventative measures? And an interest particularly of mine would be in nutrition, education, the mental health, just trying to get ahead of the problem so we don't have a growing problem.
Sure. First, on the issue of refugees coming into this community, I see Mike Malara back there from Catholic Charities and Interfaith Works. The two organizations are our agencies that receive individuals into this country. When we look at the success of refugees and what they bring to this community, it is exponentially more positive to have our refugees here than being in the war-torn countries where they came from. They are proving to be productive citizens, all of those things. Do we assist them in the early stages to move them into jobs and all that? Yes. When, if you were to ask Mayor Stephanie Miner right now, when they were very, very excited that the census numbers had increased in 2010, it was almost 100% because of the refugees who have joined our community and really are increasing the, you know, just really expanding the fabric of our community. And so we feel, from the county perspective, just very blessed to have them here. And while sometimes there are pressures, and we hear it on the numbers, I think what is proving out is that they are becoming just very, very productive members of our community. I think your second question was about what we are doing on our end on the innovation side to address some of this. When we went through our human services reorganization a couple of years ago, one of the main things that I think has come out of this, when we looked at what our former commissioner of the Department of Social Services was responsible for, just in his line of work, our business lines, if you will, was all of our child welfare, child protective services, all of our adult protective services, and then all of our public benefits. So if you think of this, those are wildly divergent. And so by focusing on demographic, on children and family on one side, adult and long-term care on the other side, and then just having a laser focus on our public benefit programs, I think we are not only seeing the cross-integration, but the ability to be forward-thinking in a lot of different areas. Bob Long was in my office yesterday, and I'm going to let the cat out of the bag, but Bob is retiring at the end of May, and we are going to be very sad to see him go, but he has a well-deserved retirement in front of him. But he came to me to say at one of their state meetings, they have asked our department to come and talk about our integration on the adult and long-term care population, because you will see the homeless on the adult side often have mental health issues. There's so many other issues on the adult protective side that now by us putting these cases together, we are seeing better results. Same on the children and family services, our integration into the schools, having what was very controversial last year, our nurses working with our child protective workers. This is a model that we have to, I believe, accept, that we are looking at the whole person. We aren't just looking at a single deficit that someone might present with. And so if we are operating from that vantage point, I think we will have more success. Again, I know she's getting tired of this. I can't say enough about what Sarah is doing, because the other part that I think is a real, this is something that should be ingrained in all of our staff. We are public servants. We have to take that to heart. We have to treat the people who come before us with the dignity and respect they deserve. And while David Sutkowy was doing a fantastic job managing that huge department that he had, by Sarah being able to focus on this, we have now in the last year put every one of our employees through customer service training. We are putting all of our supervisors through leadership training. And we are surveying our customers to say, how are we doing? Because at the end of the day, that's what we are charged with doing. We have to do that. So I hope I answered that on that perspective. And everything you said about, you know, food, nutrition, education, mental health, integrating these departments, again, lets us look at that whole person rather just like the idea that you can segment a person and cut them up and deal with this, but not deal with the whole aspect, I think is a little short-sighted.
Thank you, Ann Rooney. Thank you for your presentation and for all that you do.